For 3 years in the late 1980s, there was no boxer who was more feared than Mike Tyson. He was a devastating puncher and a master of intimidation. And when he defeated Trevor Burbick in late 1986, he became, at age 20, the youngest heavyweight champion in the history of the sport. But in the 1990s, his life seemed to unravel. Drugs and alcohol fueled his lavish lifestyle. A rape conviction, for which he continues to maintain his innocence, led to 3 years in federal prison. And an ear-biting incident during a bout with Evander Holyfield made Mike Tyson one of the most controversial figures in the history of sports. In 2005, he quit boxing, began to face his inner demons, and his struggle for redemption is the subject of a new memoir called Undisputed Truth, written with Larry Sloman. And this coming Saturday at 8 p.m., HBO will present a special film of his recent one-man Broadway show, directed by Spike Lee, also called Undisputed Truth. And I'm very pleased that all of that brings Mike Tyson to our studio today. Hello.
Hey, Leonard. How you doing, buddy?
I'm okay. So let's talk first about your one-man show. It had a very successful run on Broadway in the summer of 2012. Since then, haven't you performed it on stages around the world?
I just came back from Dubai last night.
Dubai? How much did they know about your life story?
Well, a lot. Most of the people that were there were foreigners. So the capacity of the crowd was pretty much foreigners. And around 20 people from, that was from the royal family, Emirates, I believe, they were there. And it was so ironic because the Emirates, I guess they were called the Emirates people, they want to be so, they stand out so much because, like, normal chair, just like a fold-out chair, like in an auditorium, you bend the chair down. And they, and the Emirates, the locals, they had very plush, you know what I mean, carpet-looking, leather, convertible chairs, you know, really lavish.
That's what happens when you have a lot of oil money to burn.
Yeah, yeah. They want to distinguish themselves.
So what came first, the show or the idea for the memoir?
The show.
You've done some
That's not really true. The memoir was first, but when Sloman first asked questions about it, at that time, I didn't know how to handle it, and that was some really yucky stuff started coming up. And I said, hey, get the hell away from me. I don't want to talk about this stuff. And then I believe 2 years later, I got married, and I needed some money, too. Can't forget that. And I decided to be honest with him and do it.
Well, you've done some acting. You were in The Hangover and The Hangover Part
Absolutely.
Two.
I was so
Have you taken acting lessons?
Let me see. One time.
Because you really do come across rather naturally on the stage. But this show has to be a lot harder than appearing in a movie. You're alone on stage and you have a lot of script to remember. What made you think you could pull off something like this?
I didn't think, but I knew when I saw Chaz Palminteri, me and my wife went and visited one of his shows called The Bronx Tale on Stage, and he was just magnificent as he portrayed certain characters, and he was just brilliant. He was it was better than the actual movie. He did the movie by himself, single-handedly. And I was explaining to my wife, who was with me, and said, baby, I believe I could do something similar to this, because when I'm in Europe and Asia, that's what I do. I'm on stage talking about myself. But in this particular situation, I'd take questions from the crowd, but I wouldn't do that if I did like Mr. Palminteri.
Well, your wife, Kiki, co-wrote the script to the show with playwright Randy Johnson. But what was it like working with her on this project? For instance, revisiting past misdeeds, especially ones that involved other women.
I don't feel that way with my wife. I'm very comfortable talking about anything with her.
Well, has it been difficult to relive some of the obviously painful moments in your life on the stage in such a public
way? Well, not on the stage, but more in a sit-down discussion like as I was doing my memoirs. That's more difficult than if I'm doing them on stage. And because on stage I'm being very objective and I'm not Mike Tyson. I'm an actor portraying Mike Tyson. And I don't get too emotionally involved with the situation.
And you have a lot of laugh lines.
Oh, absolutely, yes.
That I'm sure, also eases some of the pain.
Yes.
What surprised you most about doing this type of performance? Have you received any negative reactions?
Well, not that I know of. I don't read the reviews. People tell me about the reviews, and I don't guess people tell me about any of the negative ones. So they only told me about the good ones.
The book has been described as raw and brutally honest, and yet I'm struck also by the humor in it, your self-deprecation and your reflections and your self-reflection and your storytelling. At one point, when you're describing yourself, you write, "It's amazing how a low self-esteem and a huge ego can give you delusions of grandeur." Is that still an accurate description of how you see yourself?
No, not a problem. Not at all. I don't even like to express how I see myself now. But those things only flare up when I'm frightened, when I'm scared, and I get those delusions of grandeur, you know.
And what frightens you?
I don't know. Failing. You know, I don't do anything, even like, in particular, my show. I don't do anything unless I have it's a possibility I'm going to humiliate myself. And like doing the one-man show, for instance, being on stage, live audience and stuff, taking a chance of being, I don't know, heckled. There's people not enjoying it at all.
Do people ever heckle you?
No, I heckle the crowd.
Yeah. And but there is some interaction at times.
Yes, because I'm heckling and I'm harassing people. And, I think that's how I break the ice, and I go on the offensive in life, and that's how I am. I'm very offensive in life.
My guest is Mike Tyson. He has written, with the help of Larry Sloman, a memoir called Undisputed Truth. It's published by Blue Rider Press. There's also an HBO documentary, a Spike Lee joint, that will be aired this coming Saturday at 8 p.m. on HBO. In the book, you describe some of the specific significant turning points in your life, and the first seems to be when your mother lost her job and with it your apartment in Brooklyn's Bedford-Stuyvesant neighborhood, and then you had to move to Brownsville.
Pretty much. That's what I really remember, moving to Brownsville after staying a short period of time in Bedford-Stuyvesant.
Because you were very young when you had to move. How old were you?
I cannot remember. I remember when I was going to school, we were still in the 70s, because I was doing 74, 75 for the heading for school.
Now, you describe being bullied as a young boy.
Well, you know, I was a fat kid with a lisp and glasses, and I always hung out with my sister at that time. So, I don't know, so people might have called me Fairy Boy. It may have just made fun of me because I wasn't too masculine at the time.
And, did you ever try to retaliate?
No. I don't know why I never did. I just don't know. And that's so ironic, because that's what fear does to you. And I realize that as a fighter, as an adult, that's what fear does. It frightens you in your tracks, that you're afraid to even breathe, actually.
But you also didn't have a serious male role model at that point.
No,
not until Customato, which years later.
I learned from the streets. Guys would tell me to fight back and this or that, they would teach me how to steal, but never a serious model, exactly like you were saying, until Cuss got involved in my life.
Your mother, Lorna Mae Tyson, had dreams and ambitions for herself that never came to pass. What got in her way?
Men and alcohol, smoking, the lifestyle, I believe. I'm a lot like my mother. You know, it's like that fast life. It's really entrenched in that lifestyle.
An addictive personality?
Big time, yes.
You're right. I never saw my mother happy with me or proud of me doing something. I never got a chance to talk to her or know her. Professionally, that would have no effect on me, but emotionally and psychologically, it was crushing. Have you been able to make peace with her memory?
Well, no way. Yes, that never happened. You know, I had to
make peace
with myself.
Because she died too early?
Well, she didn't like me. She didn't like my attitude, especially as once I came back from living with Cuss for a short period of time. I won a few championships, national championships, and I had this tremendous, outrageous ego. You know, I broke records from knocking guys out, and I've never had nothing and no accomplishments in my life. And that just took me to, it catapulted me to a degree of arrogance that she's never witnessed before.
But don't you have to have that kind of self-confidence to do well in the ring? You have to believe going to win.
But I don't believe my mother. She just couldn't believe how arrogant I was. We're living in this really crappy apartment and stuff, and I'm telling her how great I'm going to be, and I'm going to be the greatest fighter that God created, because this is what Cuss is telling me. This is what he pretty much brainwashed me and embedded in my mind that was going to happen. And I guess my mother never was there from the beginning process of that.
Well, Cuss was right, at least for a brief time in your life. You were you were the youngest heavyweight champion ever, and you just kept on knocking guys out in the first or second round. So many of those early bouts didn't last
teacher.
Very long.
I had a really great teacher.
But by the time you were 10, this after the bullying, you'd fallen in with a pretty rough crowd, and then you were arrested. How old were you when you were arrested?
I've been arrested from 10 to 12, and I've been arrested over probably 30 times before I was 13.
And you wound up being sent to a facility upstate for the, called the Tryon School for
Boys? Tryon School for Boys, yes.
So is that where you met Customato?
No, I met Bobby Stewart up there. And from Bobby Stewart, who was once a fighter of Customato, and he introduced me to Cus.
You do a very funny imitation of Bobby Stewart in
the show. Bobby Stewart's a wonderful man.
A lot of the show involves physical humor. I know a boxer has to almost be a dancer. So is that choreographed?
I don't know if I'm a dancer. I just that I'm good at mimicking people. I'm good at maybe not mimicking them of who they are, but just making a different appearance that's not it's pretty pervasive. It's not me.
So again, you're kind of suggesting that you're at your best when you're playing somebody else rather
Absolutely,
than being yourself.
Yes, because I won't never have a chance to feel sorry for myself. Because actually, I'll start getting sorry for myself and say, wow, I'm really nobody. Like, I lived in those abandoned buildings with my family, and my mother was, you know, always drunk and with different men, and my father didn't care about us. And that would make me feel sorry for myself, and I would just be disastrous on stage.
On the other hand, you had all those successes as a boxer. What was your first impression of Customato?
I don't know. He's a weird dude. You know, this old white man telling me these great things about me. I thought he was a pervert or something. I had no idea what was going on, but what he was doing was building my self-esteem and confidence up. I didn't understand that at that particular time, of course.
And you also talk about being very confused because around this time you wound up living in two worlds. You were living in a white world, and you were also living back in Brownsville.
Absolutely. I would go to visits every now and then. I would rob houses. I never got arrested, thank God. And I eventually, as my friend who died, he was telling me, man, he knew about Cuss. He was older, and his parents knew about Cuss. And they said, hey, man, that's that guy that had Floyd Patterson. They said, man, stay up there. He knows what he's doing, man. Stay up there with that white man. Trust me, that white man loves you, man. And I listened to my friends. You know, I just went up there with him, stayed with him, got entrenched with him, and Cuss would just talk to me for hours and hours and hours. And he used some of, like, now as I think about it, it was like a brainwash. He used to hypnotize me and tell me these wonderful things about myself. And I'm a ferocious fighter. I'm a juggernaut. No man ever created can ever beat you if you listen to me, and all these beautiful things.
And then he died just months before you became the youngest heavyweight champion.
8 months before I became champion.
What effect did his death have?
Oh, man. I don't know. That was just the beginning of my downhill in life.
You think that if he had lived longer, you probably would have had a different life?
100%, yes. 100%.
Because he would have been there constantly encouraging you to stay on the straight and narrow.
Well, I was constantly, my objective was always to make him happy. So I never had a father, but always, and then I understood what it was like to have a father and to always make him happy. Like, I see a lot of guys that always wanted to make their father proud. And I always was happy to make him proud, because once I had fights and I won fights in spectacular fashion, he would be so happy, and I would be so proud that I made him so happy.
You sound like you've been in psychoanalysis.
I don't know. I might have. I don't remember.
Mike Tyson is here. He has written a memoir with the help of Larry Sloman called Undisputed Truth. It's published by Blue Rider Press. And also there is a film of his one-man show called Undisputed Truth. And HBO is going to be airing it on this coming Saturday at 8 p.m. You were pretty tough fighter. As I mentioned, you won your first 19 professional fights by knockout, 12 of those knockouts coming in the first rounds. Did you have a strategy? Was it the body and then the head or something?
Make the myth and counter. Punch and make the myth, be elusive and ferocious.
Well, but every boxer goes into the ring with that concept.
I think Listen, I've read about all the great warriors of time, you know, Dionysus, Alexander the Great, Attila the Hun. I read about them all. I read about their strategies. And I guess, I always thought of myself as a reincarnation of them.
And then you lost your title.
1990.
Yeah, you'd only been holding it for 3 years in what some people think is one of the greatest upsets in the history of boxing.
Well,
Buster Douglas.
Buster Douglas fought a great fight that night, and I could have fought better, but he prepared better than I did that particular evening.
Had you become too overconfident?
Perhaps, yes.
In 1991, you were accused of raping Desiree Washington, who was a contestant in a beauty pageant in Indianapolis. And a year later, you went on trial. You were convicted, but for two decades, you have maintained your innocence. Many women are reluctant to reveal that they have been raped. Why do you think she accused you?
I have no idea. I wish I knew. Perhaps financial gain.
You mean she was asking for money to keep it quiet?
No, but she received money. Mm-hmm. She received money after I was convicted. She filed financial case against me. But she did that. She grabbed a lawyer right as soon as she accused me of doing that situation.
Well, it sure wasn't a great career move for her. We haven't heard much about Desiree Washington.
Well, I heard people told me that she got facelift and she changed her look and no one knows who she is anymore.
On the other hand, you've said that going to prison was something of a blessing.
Well, at that particular time it was, because I had no self-sense of anything, who I was at that particular time. And I went there and it had to have been for a blessing, because I wouldn't have survived the way I was living out in the streets. Mm-hmm. At that particular stage of my life.
You also had a religious conversion.
Yes, I became a Muslim.
Now, a lot of people do that, and often it doesn't seem to last.
Well, that's just who I am as a person. And I just put the two together. You know, I'm not the most perfect man in the world. I wasn't that way as a Christian. I'm not going to be that way as a Muslim. But I have a great deal of gratitude and my love for all the creations of God. And I put in my work.
Well, one of the big surprises is that you hooked up with Don King, the boxing promoter.
Well, I was with Don King before I went to prison.
But he didn't his notorious reputation alert you that he might be a problem?
He had me fooled big time.
Was he doing something similar to Cuss, telling you were just great and everything?
No, by that time I already knew who I was, but just he was, he made me believe that we were going to go through the situation together and it was going to be us against the world. It was just that stuff, and I don't really blame him. I don't blame him.
But he stole from you.
Yeah, but listen, I've done bad things to people too, and if I want to be forgiven for the things I've done to people, I have to forgive people for the things they've done to me as well.
So you've forgiven him?
Oh, I forgive everybody. I make amends with everyone in my life, and I just have a cleaner conscience. You know what I mean? Money's not the biggest obstacle in my life. It's not it doesn't really make me who I am. I'm still Mike. If I'm broke, I have a few dollars in the bank, a car or a chariot or a bicycle. It's just me, Mike.
You took time during an August press conference to announce that you'd suffered a relapse in your recovery from drugs and alcohol. In a very painful moment, you said, "I'm on the verge of dying because I'm a vicious alcoholic." And then you went on to say it had been 6 days since you'd used drugs and alcohol and that you'd been lying to friends and family about staying sober. How's your life been since that day?
Well, I'm good right now. Well, listen, I don't know. I've been sober 90 days. And, you know, I think to myself, I don't know, maybe I'm not meant to be this way. You know what I mean? Who knows? I want to. But maybe I'm not meant to be sober all the time. Maybe I'm killing myself trying to stay sober, trying to make my wife love me, make my friends like me if I'm in that state.
But you've often talked about a darkness that you feel. Maybe you are depressive to some degree and you're self-medicating with alcohol or drugs.
Hey, listen, I used to want to get better, you know. And sometimes I wonder, do I want to get better for myself or do I want to get better for the people that I love? Do I want to be a service for my kids? Do I want to be present? You know, it's a real peculiar battle that I'm dealing with.
Well, you also talk a lot about your education in other areas since you left the ring, learning new words and going through speech therapy.
No, I've never been to speech therapy in my life.
Oh, I thought you said that.
Never
in
my life. Imagine me going to school. No, I had speech coaching during my show. When I did the show, I was getting speech coach, And because I guess I was lisping, I was saying.
Well, your lisp is a lot less obvious than it was.
I'm not conscious of it.
How do you imagine you'll be using your new skills in the future? Will you be doing more acting?
I would love to. That's just what I love doing, a lot of stage acting. I can't imagine filling out a job employment form. I just couldn't imagine. That would be very funny. That would be a common sketch in itself.
But you'd have a hard time, I suspect, getting some jobs because of your tattoos, your facial tattoos.
Well, I did
on Maori?
Yes. I did a few shows when they covered it up.
In the play, you just dismiss it and suggest that people have to learn to live with it.
Well, I did, so they do too.
Uh-huh. Are you an AA?
I don't know if I'm an AA, but I'm in therapy. You know, I go to my meetings.
Uh-huh. And you look like you're working it out, although I suspect a relapse could be a problem for you again.
Well, I hope not. You know, I hope not. I'm not going to lie and say, hey, I got it under control.
So what do you want people to know about you that they don't know?
I don't want them to know anything about me. They know too much as it is. I put everything that I know about myself basically in my book.
Uh-huh. You feel that this book is the total story? This is the real Mike Tyson?
To the best of my ability, yes.
Mike Tyson will be speaking at the New York Public Library on 42nd Street tonight at 7.
Yes,
did you ever think you'd be speaking at the New York Public Library?
I don't even know what's the substance of that, you know, the library. I don't know the history of the New York Public Library. I'm just a dunce in certain situations.
Well, it's at 7, and for ticket information, go to our show page at WNYC.org. He'll also be signing books tomorrow at 12:30 at the Barnes & Noble store on 5th Avenue and 46th Street. Thank you so much for being on our show.
It's a pleasure being here, my friend.